It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
I'm Brian Kilmeade.
I'm Kennedy.
I'm Sean Duffy, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Monday, March 13th, 2023, I'm Mike Emanuel. Republicans and Democrats in Congress don't agree on much, but House lawmakers voted unanimously to declassify all information related to COVID-19 origins.
Everyone should want to know the cause of this virus. Where did it come from? How was it funded? And to hold not only China accountable, to hold perhaps those within our own administration accountable, but to also ensure that this never happens again.
I'm Chris Foster. It's 20 years since Elizabeth Smart came home, 9 months after being kidnapped.
That was unbelievable. When I heard it, I asked him where the body was, because it just wasn't fathomable that she would still be alive. And when he said, now she's in the room next to me, I mean, I just gasped.
And I'm Kaylee McEnany. I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
Republicans say President Biden's massive budget proposal is dead on arrival on Capitol Hill. Senator John Kennedy from Louisiana says he's still in shock.
The president's budget took my breath away. It's a $6.9 trillion budget, $4.7 trillion in new taxes that will affect everyone over 10 years. The only way I know how to improve the president's budget is with a shredder.
And yet President Biden insists his budget blueprint is fiscally responsible.
My plan, after it's all said and done, is going to cut the deficit nearly $3 trillion over the next 10 years, the plan I've submitted.
House Speaker Kevin McCarthy says it's time for the president to get real.
This is not a serious budget, and real leadership matters here. Don't play games with the debt ceiling.
A new Republican majority in the House is also digging in pretty aggressively on the origin of COVID-19 and how top public health officials handled it. Dr. Robert Redfield, former director of the Centers for Disease Control, is critical of former White House chief medical advisor Dr. Anthony Fauci and former NIH director Dr. Francis Collins, who were quick to argue COVID-19 spread naturally.
No, I think people know that I disagree with Tony on this pretty aggressively. I think that his approach and Collins' approach has really been antithetical to science.
Fauci is defending his leadership in response to COVID.
I have always kept a completely open mind that it could be one or the other. Quite frankly, the evidence weighs more likely towards one, namely a natural occurrence. But I would be perfectly accepted if there were evidence that it was a lab leak.
Congressional Republicans say they have plenty more questions for Fauci.
For 2 years, we've been pointing to the Wuhan lab as the source of the virus, saying that it was a lab leak.
Congresswoman Nicole Malliotakis is a New York Republican.
And for that same 2 year period, Dr. Fauci and administration officials were saying that this was just a conspiracy theory and it was not based on science. So here we are 2 years later, and everything seems to be pointing to the fact that we were correct. And now the question really is, why was Dr. Fauci doing everything he can to suppress that theory? And we had an interesting hearing this week with a number of individuals who came forward to point to the fact that it was the lab leak theory. And one of those individuals was the former CDC director, Dr. Redfield, who told us straight out that he was shut out of conversations with Dr. Fauci and the WHO and the head of the UK's Health Institute. And he believes it was because he had a differing opinion, which was based on science, that this was indeed a lab leak theory. So it's clear that Dr. Fauci was looking to suppress this information. The real question is why.
You had Dr. Redfield under oath, so he had no reason to lie. Presumably, at some point, you're going to get Dr. Fauci there under oath. And then what do you think his answer will be?
Well, see, that's why we're inviting those individuals who were around Dr. Fauci, because when Dr. Fauci did come before Congress, he simply kept saying he doesn't remember, he doesn't remember. So we need to invite those individuals who do remember and are willing to share this information. Well, the real bombshell, I thought, from the hearing the other day was that Dr. Redfield said that he has no doubt, this was quote, unquote, no doubt, that our American tax dollars went to fund the gain of function research at the Wuhan lab, and that it's likely it was funding the development of this virus. And the money was not just the money from the NIH, which was funneled through the EcoHealth Alliance in New York City and then made its way to the Wuhan lab. He suspects the funding also comes from Department of State, USAID, Department of Defense. And so the question then also begs, is that why Dr. Fauci was trying to suppress the lab leak theory?
Following that COVID hearing, you joined with your colleagues in the House to cast a unanimous vote to declassify all information relating to potential links between the Wuhan Institute of Virology and COVID's origins. First, are you surprised it was unanimous and pleasantly surprised? And what do you hope that comes from this?
Well, I was happy that this was something that we can actually agree on, and it should be a bipartisan unanimous vote, because everyone should want to know the cause of this virus. Where did it come from? How was it funded? And to hold not only China accountable, to hold perhaps those within our own administration accountable, but to also ensure that this never happens again. There have been nearly as many Americans who have died from COVID than every war in American history combined. And so we owe it to the public to get answers, to get accountability, to ensure this never happens again, and certainly ensure that we are never funding any type of research in a communist country that it seems that we were doing here. And so, you know, I think this is a real good step for transparency and accountability. The only thing that really bothers me is that for the last 2 years, the Democrats on this committee have stonewalled. They refuse to hold hearings on the origins. They refuse to try to get any accountability. And really, now that the Republicans are in charge, we're getting answers and we're getting transparency. And now we have to move forward and get that accountability as well.
All right, let's talk economy. Earlier this week, as a member of the Ways and Means Committee, you had the opportunity to question Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen about her delay in notifying Congress that the U.S. was on trajectory to hit the debt limit, saying the American public deserves to know how long the Biden administration was aware that certain spending packages were pushing the U.S. toward the debt limit. Yellen claimed there was no malice in her actions and that she was just exercising caution before sounding the alarm about the debt limit. What were your thoughts on Secretary Yellen's response to your questions, and were you satisfied with what she had to say?
Well, there's definitely a reason why Secretary Yellen had been quiet that entire period throughout the negotiation of that $1.7 trillion omnibus. After it was passed, she remained quiet, as if the White House told her to just not comment on this. How are you the Treasury Secretary? You do not sound the alarm when Congress and the president are looking to jam through another massive spending bill if you know that the debt limit is approaching and that you would need to take extraordinary measures. So what I find interesting is that there was no discussion about hitting the debt limit or the need to take these measures until the Republicans took control of the House, and then they try now to dump it on our lap. So what I did find out from that hearing was that obviously the president was well aware that he was going to hit the debt limit and go have these problems, and he still moved forward with spending that massive amount of money, which obviously was incredibly irresponsible. And I think that Secretary Yellen should be a little more vocal, be a little more transparent. It seems to me that she's simply carrying this administration's water. At the very end of my questioning, I asked her whether the spending of money, I said that clearly the spending of money, raising these interest rates at the same time is bad for the economy, that we have many people struggling in my district. Seniors can't stay in their home. Young people can't afford to buy a new home. And she basically told me that the printing and spending of more money does not lead to inflation, which is absolutely ridiculous for a Treasury Secretary to say. So once again, she's carrying the water of this administration instead of doing what is the right thing for the economic future of our country.
I want to ask you about President Biden's budget proposal, and obviously presidential budgets are always dead on arrival on Capitol Hill. You folks in Congress have the power of the purse, but it's an opportunity for the president to lay out his priorities. Any major surprises, such as wanting to raise taxes on high earners and corporations?
Yeah, once again, Joe Biden says one thing and then does another. He says he cares about Made in America. If he cares about Made in America, we'd not put forward a budget. Again, once again, looking to tax our food producers, our energy producers, our manufacturers in this country. And so it is a budget that is not good for job creation. It's a budget that is not good for keeping costs low on American families. It spends too much. It taxes too much. And certainly with Republicans now in charge of the House, we are one third of the pie. This budget is clearly dead on arrival. And I think that, you know, what we're doing is pushing the Democrats to try to work with us to cut wasteful spending. You know, our first Ways and Means hearing, we talked about nearly $500 billion in fraud in the various COVID packages. There is a bunch of inspectors, general reports that come and point to wasteful spending across government agencies, cost-saving measures that we should be taking place. There's no reason to be increasing spending at this time. We need to slow it down so we can really reduce inflation and get this economy back on track. And the president's budget certainly does not do that. In fact, he wants to increase the corporate tax rate to one that is higher than that of communist China. And again, that would hurt those people who are trying to produce here in America.
Lastly, let's dig into some legislation you've been working on. Last month, Senator John Kennedy introduced your bill, the Prosecutors Need to Prosecute Act, in the Senate, which aims to hold district attorneys accountable. The bill asks that DAs are required to report the number of violent crimes they declined to prosecute and how many criminals were released under their authority, among other things. What was your inspiration behind this bill, and do you think it would help the United States get a handle on the rampant crime that we're seeing in many major American cities?
Yeah, well, you saw not too long ago how San Francisco recalled their district attorney. So the goal of my bill is to expose those rogue district attorneys who are not doing their job. They're not prosecuting crime. They're releasing our repeat offenders back onto our streets. They're dropping charges, reducing charges. The goal is to get that information out in the public so that way they can be held accountable by either recall or in the next election, but also so that can be taken into account when we're issuing federal grants. Because if they're not doing their job, then they don't need the federal funds to not do their job. And so I think it's a good, transparent piece of legislation we hope to get passed. And as you know, we just nullified the DC crime law, which reduces maximum sentences for criminals. And that's because we believe everyone should be able to go to their nation's capital and be safe. We want to see that echoed throughout the rest of the country. Sadly, we don't have that jurisdiction over city and state governments, but we can keep exposing what they're doing so the public can hold them accountable.
Obviously, Republicans have a narrow majority in the House and are the minority party in the Senate. Do you feel like the issue of this legislation is bipartisan enough that it really should pass both chambers?
Yeah, look, I think it should. In fact, though, sadly, we're having some in our own party who do not support the legislation because they feel that it is impeding on city and state governments. Obviously, those are people that come from areas where they have good DAs, not like me here in New York City, where we have to use every measure possible to expose them and hold them accountable. So I'm hopeful that we continue to work on this legislation to try to move it forward. But look, we're about law and order, our party, right? We want secure borders. We want safe streets in America. We want to make sure that we're giving our CBP agents and our drug enforcement agents the tools they need to do their job, to stop terrorists from entering our country, to stop the fentanyl from entering our country. And that is the good thing about we're having Republicans now. We are the only line of defense to stop the Democrats' reckless policies. So no more crazy omnibus bills, no more radical agenda bills coming forward and passing Congress. What we need to do, though, is really take back the White House as well, because now the president will try to resort to, you know, executive orders. And so we'll have to use whatever leverage we have, including the power of the purse, to push this administration to do the right thing when it comes to these issues.
Congressman Nicole Malliotakis of the great state of New York, thank you so much for your time. Have a great week.
Thank you, Mike.
Wyndham Hotels and Resorts makes travel possible for all. Whether it's the long haulers looking for a great cup of coffee, a roomier rest for the on a whim road trippers, or a place to make summer memories with the whole family. No matter who you are, where you're going, or why, with 24 trusted brands to choose from like La Quinta, Days Inn, and Super 8, your Wyndham is waiting. Get the lowest price at WyndhamHotels.com. Restrictions apply. Visit website for more details.
This is Kaylee McEnany with your Fox News commentary, coming up.
It's been 20 years since Elizabeth Smart was rescued. She was kidnapped in the middle of the night from her home in Utah, June 5th, 2002. Her father, Ed, later that day.
Elizabeth, if you're out there, we're doing everything we possibly can to help you.
We love you. We want you to come home safely to us.
She was missing for 279 days, held captive by a couple on the outskirts of Salt Lake City, then in San Diego County, California. They returned to Utah at Elizabeth's suggestion, and with the man who took her now publicly identified and spotted by people who called the police, Elizabeth was found March 12, 2003, and reunited with her family. She went on Fox's Hannity and Combs 3 years later during a trip to Washington to fight for new sex offender legislation.
Have you become aware of just how involved people were in your disappearance?
You know, I have people come up to me all the time and just tell me how much they love me and how much they prayed for me. And I don't think I realize how big it is, but or was. But, you know, I appreciate everything that everyone did for me.
As for her captors, Wanda Barzee spent 15 years in prison. Brian David Mitchell was convicted in 2010, later sentenced to life in prison.
Today is a wonderful day, and I'm so thrilled to be here. I'm so thrilled with the verdict.
It's real.
That's Elizabeth's father, Ed. Back to her rescue 20 years ago.
After 9.5 months, it was particularly unexpected.
Chris Thomas helped the Smart family with public relations during Elizabeth's captivity. His new book is called Unexpected: The Backstory of Finding Elizabeth Smart and Growing Up in the Culture of an American Religion. He and the Smarts are members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
To give you a little background on that day, there had been some negative press that morning, and we had planned a press briefing for later that afternoon. And Ed Smart was going to meet with me to prepare for that. And a few minutes before our meeting, he called and said, I've been summoned to the Sandy City Police Department and told not to stop and not to talk to anybody, but I'm going to be late to the meeting. Wanted to give you a heads up. And fortuitously, one of the only people I'd kept in contact with from high school, my basketball teammate, Jason Burnett, was a detective with the Sandy City Police Department. And I was able to get a hold of him. And finally, he was able to relay the information that Elizabeth was alive and well. And that was unbelievable. When I heard it, I asked him where the body was, because it just wasn't fathomable that she would still be alive. And when he said, now she's in the room next to me, I mean, I just gasped. And I was able to get a hold of Ed and inform him before he got to the station, and then the rest of the Smart family. So that day was surreal. But yeah, that morning, there was no sign. I mean, interest in the story had waned to a point where, you know, we weren't really doing very many interviews and there really wasn't much interest.
Yeah, I mean, I'm old enough to have been in my business when this happened, and my first response and everybody's first response was, oh, they found the body. And then what? They found her? I mean, it just doesn't, it's so rare.
It isn't in that day even more so. I mean, we've seen a handful since that time where they have come back. And I think the case kind of, you know, pierced the national consciousness that when a child goes missing, that doesn't always mean there's going to be a sad outcome. And so I think how we look at and how the media covers missing children has changed significantly over the years.
Yeah. You and the family and Elizabeth had to sort of have coexist the joy of her being home and the horror of what she'd gone through. You write that you wish you hadn't heard some of it.
Absolutely. That morning after she came home, Ed just needed to talk and told me a lot of what she had said the night before. And it was ugly. A lot of that came out in the trial. What happened to her, you know, was heinous. It's unthinkable that someone would do that to a child. And yet seeing how she's responded and how the family has responded to that has been incredibly inspiring.
Yeah. I mean, she could have gone into her shell. She could have changed her name. She could have dyed her hair dark and done whatever she wanted with her life. But she's remained an activist for women and girls and abuse victims.
And she really carries on a legacy. If we go back, you know, when Elizabeth was missing, her father, Ed, was just lost once the interest was starting to wane. And he asked me, what can we get involved with? Where can we make a difference? And we got involved with the legislation for the National Amber Alert, which he played a huge role in helping pass, but really took that tragedy and tried to make something good from that. And Elizabeth has carried that on in an amazing way. And she's such an inspiration to so many people, myself included.
At first, you guys really welcomed all the press you could get. The more eyeballs, the more ears, the better chance that somebody might have seen her or known something. And that eventually, you write, kind of backfired, right?
It did a little bit. And I would say we still kept a real open mind and did most of the interviews. You know, made it really clear early on to the Smarts that working with the media is a two-edged sword, that they are an incredible tool for getting the information out. And on the flip side, they're going to look into you. They're going to scrutinize you.
And it's not out of the question that, you know, things can happen that that may frustrate you. And they were very courageous and said, we don't care. We want to do whatever it takes. If they tear us apart, let them do that.
Yeah, there were some unnecessary shots at the family, some flat out false stories that came out during the course of all this. Now, Elizabeth's little sister, Mary Catherine, was in the room that night when she was taken. And the advice, which I found was interesting, was give her space. And memory works in weird ways. And you just never know when something's going to bubble up. And it did. Like, 4 months later, it kind of came to her who this guy might have been.
Right. It was in October. So about four and a half months after Elizabeth went missing. Now, a lot of people don't realize it was dark in the room that night when Elizabeth was abducted. And Mary Catherine did not get a good look at the individual, but she heard the voice and it was familiar to her. And while she was reading the Guinness Book of World Records, all of a sudden she remembered, hey, it was that man, Emmanuel, who worked on their roof one afternoon. He was barely there. Ed was shocked that she even knew who he was.
Yeah, that was just the name that this guy went by at the time. And yeah, it's nuts that, did she even really speak to him? She just kind of, it's weird that she remembered that voice. Now, the cops, as happens occasionally with the media and investigators, they fixated on this other guy to the detriment of the case, you say. Richard Ritchie, this guy who's dead now, he was the guy to the point where the family was even undermined. And you were undermined when you tried to publicize this new suspect.
There was a lot of tension. So after Mary Catherine had that epiphany, the family, of course, immediately contacted law enforcement, and they were very reticent to come forward with it. They were so caught up, as you mentioned, Chris, on the Richard Ritchie suspect. There was so much circumstantial evidence that pointed to the fact that he could be the guy. The only piece of evidence that wasn't there is that Mary Catherine, even initially, when he was named as a suspect, said he didn't do it, and then later identified somebody new. But there was a lot of turmoil inside of the family, trying to figure out what to do. Do we stay the course with law enforcement, or do we defile them and come forward with it? And it wasn't until February that they finally came out with the information, and then the police sabotaged it. They told the media that I had concocted the story and that they'd investigated the guy. They didn't think there was much there, and to be very careful. And so, you know, from a media standpoint, who do you trust, Chris? Do you trust law enforcement, or do you trust the Smart Family spokesperson?
Yeah. And I mean, your supposed rationale was to make something up would have been just to keep the story out there.
Yeah, but it's ludicrous because, you know, your credibility would erode immediately.
Right.
But yeah, that's what they were saying, is that I was trying to get her back into the news.
Something else that was kept quiet for a long time that may have led to Elizabeth being found earlier was this break-in at her cousin Olivia's house. Tell that story.
Yeah. So 8 weeks after Elizabeth went missing, there was a break-in in the middle of the night at her cousin's house. And it was ironic for a couple of reasons. One was because her cousin Olivia was her best friend. So it wasn't like this was some random cousin. And secondly, the circumstances surrounding the break-in were eerily similar to what happened at the Smart House when Elizabeth was abducted. The screen was cut, a hand came inside, yet the police didn't want this coming out. And then when the news did break 4 weeks later, the national news during that period had picked up the satellite trucks and moved on. And the police at that point said, you know, we really think it was a teenage prank, which was so unfortunate, because I think if they had really looked into this, I think if the media had looked into this in that moment, there may have been a very different story and a different outcome.
I remember the public celebration. Well, first of all, let me go back to the day she was found. It's not like cops tracked this couple down and kicked in doors. They just found Elizabeth, right? She freed herself.
Yeah, a couple of interesting things on that. I talked about how the media panned that, you know, nationally. In fact, interesting point, standing under the ticker there at the News Corp building, you know, after everyone had canceled interviews. We were in New York trying to do interviews that morning. No one wanted to do those. John Walsh was the only person that would take the story up and put it on America's Most Wanted and quickly identified who this guy was. And then Elizabeth on the other side was absolutely genius. She went to Brian David Mitchell and said, hey, I've had this revelation from God that we need to go back to Utah, that there are lots of women, lots of young girls that go to these camps up in the mountains, and that's where we're going to get your next wife. And he took the bait and went back to Utah. And as soon as they stepped off the bus and started walking down State Street in Sandy, which is about 10 miles south of Salt Lake, a couple of America's Most Wanted viewers found and saw him, called him in, and Elizabeth was rescued.
Yeah. This is something a little bit shameful, but I think we have to admit that part of the reason that Elizabeth Smart got so much coverage is that she was a very pretty 14-year-old blonde white girl. What do you think about that discrepancy in the media coverage that some missing kids get and others don't?
No, it's absolutely true. Elizabeth recently spoke to this. She said, I probably received as much attention as all other missing children combined. And it's not fair. And it's something that, you know, at the same time, news is a business and the media is going to cover the stories that get the most eyeballs and the most clicks. It's unfortunate. I don't mean to sound like I'm harsh in any way. I think it's something that the Smart family has been very cognizant in as they've tried to get back. At the same time, having, you know, the ability to work with the media in a savvy way makes a significant difference when there are missing children cases, when there are murders, when there are other situations. I created a resource a few years back called familyspokesperson.org to help equip families in crisis with that information, with some know-how on how to better organize and how to better get their story out and work with the media in a very productive way. And so I'm hopeful that these little things will make at least a small difference as it relates to that inequality.
And you've stayed close with the family ever since, right? There's been, you know, you almost sort of, you say you almost became a bit of a brother. I mean, not that there weren't tensions every now and then, but, you know, you've been to weddings, you've been to, I assume, you know, funerals and other family events over the years.
You know, when you go through something like that, you bond and become very close. I didn't know Elizabeth before the experience and meeting her that day she was recovered was still one of the greatest experiences of my life. But since that time, you know, Elizabeth and I have become close. She's like a sister to me. We talk frequently. You know, what I would say about her is she is very much the same person privately that she is publicly. I mean, just one of the most inspirational people I've ever been around. I'm constantly amazed just by her goodness and by how much she really does care about other survivors and others who have been through similar things to her.
Chris Thomas, book about his experiences with the Smart family and his life as well. It's called Unexpected, the backstory of finding Elizabeth Smart and growing up in the culture of an American religion. Chris, good to talk to you.
Thanks so much, Chris. It's been a pleasure.
Here's a look at the week ahead.
Monday, President Biden hits the road with several planned stops around the country during the week. Monday, we'll see the president in San Diego meeting with the prime ministers of Australia and Britain. A formal announcement is expected on Australia's plan to buy 5 American-made submarines. Tuesday, President Biden will discuss gun violence during a stop in Monterey Park, California. Also on Tuesday, the first round of March Madness gets underway with 4 NCAA men's college basketball games in Dayton, Ohio. Thursday, pending court action, Florida's ban on gender-affirming medical care takes effect. It would bar doctors from prescribing puberty blockers, hormone therapy, and surgeries to treat new patients younger than 18 for gender dysphoria. Friday, the Supreme Court honors the memory of the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg with a meeting of the Supreme Court's bar, followed by a special sitting of the court. Also on Friday, break out the green as celebrations around the world mark St. Patrick's Day. And that's a look at your week ahead. I'm Rich Dennison, Fox News.
Hey, it's Will Cain, co-host of Fox and Friends Weekend. Join me as I share my thoughts on a wide range of topics, from sports and pop culture to politics and business.
The Will Cain Podcast. Subscribe and listen now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Rate and review the Fox News Rundown on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
It's time for your Fox News commentary.
Kayleigh McEnany.
What's on your mind?
New York City Mayor Eric Adams made headlines on February 28th when he said, when we took prayer out of schools, guns came in schools. Don't tell me about no separation of church and state. State is the body, church is the heart. You take the heart out of the body dies. In true form, the liberal media jumped into outrage mode. CNN labeled the comments controversial and alarming. The New York Times went with surreal. And an opinion writer at MSNBC described Adams' theocratic impulses. But Mayor Adams was exactly right in questioning the secular sacrosanct separation of church and state. While the Constitution is clear that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, the term separation of church and state is nowhere in our founding documents. Despite this, the concept has been used to create a religion of secularism, the very outcome that the Supreme Court repeatedly warned against for decades. In my forthcoming book, Serenity in the Storm, Living Through Chaos by Leaning on Christ, I explore the way in which God has been excised from society contrary to what our founders intended. In the nearly six decades since prayer was exiled from our nation's schools, America has seen not neutrality toward religion, but rather overt hostility. Just a glimpse of case law pertaining to religion in our nation's schools tells the story. In 1985, for example, the court struck down an Alabama law allowing a 60-second moment of silence for meditation or voluntary prayer in school. Student-led prayer before a football game at Santa Fe High School, even if non-sectarian and non-proselytizing, was barred. Likewise, a rabbi could not offer a prayer at a public middle school graduation ceremony. In New York, a federal court upheld the New York City Department of Education's policy that allowed the display of secular holiday symbol decorations, including but not limited to Christmas trees, menorahs, and the Islamic star and crescent, even though, according to Pew, it explicitly forbids the display of a Christmas nativity scene in public schools. As you can see, for decades, courts across the country slowly whittled away at the free exercise of faith in our schools. Ironically, even in Shemp, Murray O'Hare's case that ended prayer in schools, the court admonished against expelling religion altogether in a way that would establish a so-called religion of secularism. In his book, William Murray explores the views of various thought leaders surrounding the founding of our country. John Locke, perhaps the greatest influence on our founding fathers in the Declaration of Independence, argued for the separation of church and state while also saying this of education in a letter to a friend. With the reading of history, I think the study of morality should be joined. I mean not the ethics of the schools fitted to dispute, but Aristotle and above all the New Testament, which teaches wherein a man may learn how to live. While the prohibition of a national religion is quite clear in the Establishment Clause, our forefathers never sought to exile religion from school entirely. But this is exactly what has happened, and grave consequences have followed. William Murray noted, July 17, 1963 was the first day Baltimore's children could not pray in schools. Before that date, there had never been a murder in a Baltimore school. The nurses gave out aspirins and teachers taught English, math, history, and sciences. 30 years later, there is a Baltimore schools police force to deal with violence and drugs in schools. The nurses give out condoms and implant birth control devices that allow teenage girls to have unprotected sex. Those were Murray's words in 1993, 30 years after prayer was taken out of schools. Now, almost 60 years later, where are we? Teachers are convincing middle school students without parental notice that they may be a different gender. Kindergartners are learning about sexuality and body parts. Toxic social media, suicide, and fentanyl overdoses plague our nation's young people. Alongside the removal of God from education has come a series of ills that have tormented a generation. Nevertheless, the tide very well may be turning. I'm Kaylee McEnany, co-host of Outnumbered, and also author of the upcoming book, Serenity in the Storm, Living Through Chaos by Leaning on Christ. I'm Kaylee McEnany.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown. And now, stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com.
I'm Emily Campagno, and this is the Fox True Crime Podcast, bringing you closer to the story than you ever thought possible. Subscribe at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you download podcasts. These are the stories that keep you up at night.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
Hey there, it's me, Kennedy. Make sure to check out my podcast, Kennedy Saves the World. It is 5 days a week, every week. Download and listen at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.